Hours after the Supreme Court's decision to legalize homosexual marriage, we spoke to Princeton University law professor Dr. Robert George.
Justices and judges swear a solemn oath to be guided by the Constitution. That is not a license for them to read their own particular personal views into the Constitution.
Dr. Albert Moeller, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary.
You put those two words together, and that's a deeply Christian affirmation, isn't it, that love wins. But what you have here is really a hijacking of something that's fundamentally true that is being used to celebrate something that's fundamentally false.
Alveda King, niece of Martin Luther King Jr.
My uncle, in one of his prayers, as he was uniting a man and a woman in holy matrimony, thank God for the union of marriage and for procreation.
And Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
I'm not going to be silent. We can't be silent. Our pastors need to speak up. Call this what it is, a lie.
Your comprehensive source for news, information, and truth, Issues Etc. Listen live or on demand at issuesetc.org or on the new Lutheran Public Radio mobile app. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin on this Wednesday afternoon, July the 1st. I talk a little bit about the media's coverage of the Supreme Court decision to legalize homosexual marriage. There's been celebration. Has there also been some self-reflection on the part of the media to look at themselves and say, maybe we were smiling a little too, our grins were a little too broad on this one, maybe even evaluating its own objectivity on the Supreme Court's decision. Joining us to talk about media coverage of the Supreme Court decision to legalize homosexual marriage, Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here again.
Have the media shown the ability to be a little bit self-reflective on both their coverage before and after the Supreme Court decision?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the media isn't like the monolith in 2001, A Space Odyssey, you know, and that it's all one thing. I think we're seeing another collision here between the values of the internet era professionals and kind of the standards of traditional journalism. And in the middle, probably the best thing that's been written on this issue was at pointer.org by Al Tompkins, a longtime commentator on all things related to digital media and broadcasting in particular, his specialty. But he noted, you know, that this was raising really serious questions here, and he specifically singled out in language that I used in my Universal Syndicate column today, he particularly singled out religion. And the language he used was that you have to be especially careful when dealing with, quote, deeply held religious beliefs of many readers. Quote, whether you believe those beliefs are outdated or nonsensical should not shape your reporting when it comes to covering matters of faith. Here's the key phrase for me, and so I ended with it. It is different than covering the political and social issues around same-sex marriage. And so the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida, is probably the most prestigious continuing education organization related to mainstream journalism in America. So Poynter is saying, okay, everybody, stop and think about this. Before you start putting hashtags, you know, on all of your posts and your tweets and everything else, joining in the celebration, before you change that logo to have a rainbow pride flag in it, stop and think about this for a minute. Tompkins at Poynter asks journalists to think for a second. If the Supreme Court had come out with the opposite decision, would they have been hashtagging hate wins, or hashtag love loses, or hashtag yay religious liberty? You know, would they have felt comfortable doing the exact same gestures only for the other side, or in reaction to the, you know, negative reaction to the decision? Would the bandwagon have seemed the same? And his point, of course, is that this is not proper behavior by journalists at all. No matter what their own personal feelings about. However, once again, the online era is different. I think you and I have discussed before that the one thing the internet does extremely well, maybe more than anything else related to news and information, is divide people up into tiny niche audiences that are specifically interested in their content. And once you start that process, it's kind of hard to pull back and not talk to your own choir, so to speak, not preach to them.
So the hashtags, let's talk about those, because those are a feature of not just online reporting, but of the parallel world of social media, in particular Twitter, that many of these reporters, online reporters, occupy 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, God love them, they can be there as much as they want, but the hashtag is quite often cannot avoid being an editorial statement, can it?
Of course. And yeah, there's no way around that, which means we're trapped. The media wants social media because it's crucial to the business model, if there is one, for the future of the creation of news and information. You can't avoid social media right now. And Facebook is the voice of kind of middle America, and in particular the young, whereas Twitter, the segment of the population that it appeals to, tends to be the East Coast, maybe the Upper Midwest, and the West Coast in terms of really intense usage, and maybe college zip codes. But my observation is that things got more vicious on Facebook than on Twitter this time around. At least that's what I'm hearing, you know, from the people that I follow pretty closely. And I've had editors, you know, who were on both sides of this particular issue, saying that the commentary that they received in online boards and comment pages and stuff like that was vicious to a degree this time around, that it caught them totally off guard. And what that says to me in particular is that the nation still remains highly divided, which brings up the very issue then, if the nation is very highly divided on some of these issues, why has the media decided to signal that the debate is already over in terms of news coverage? Does that make people feel good out there being interviewed by the mainstream press when on Twitter the very same reporters are dancing in the aisles? And in some cases, some publications, most of them online publications, some have actually changed their logos to be a part of the celebration. That can't endear trust on the side of the nation that is upset about the decision, or upset about perhaps the religious liberty implications of the decision, even if they believe that this was the proper thing for the government to do. There really is not just one or two camps here. There are multiple.
I'm curious about something you just said there, the media in some sense signaling that the debate is over. I think most people, especially students of history, just know a little thing about a Supreme Court decision called Roe v. Wade, realize the debate might have about 50 years of life left in it at the very mm-hmm. least. But I'm curious about that because it seemed to me that once the celebration, kind of the media celebration, died down, they don't, at least to my, and I could be wrong, you watch this a lot closer than I could, they wanted to move on to something else. Why talk about it anymore? The subject is settled.
Well, except the subject, of course, isn't settled, because America remains, even if there are only 20 to 25% of the American public that remains intensely active in a religious tradition of some traditional form, that's still a massive amount of people. And this religious world has, you know, an amazing number of parallel institutions and stuff, which now we have to adjudicate. This brings, of course, you and I back to our previous conversations about the Health and Human Services mandate, that the press keeps pretending that this is, things are going to be okay inside the doors of your churches. This isn't a secular world versus churches situation. There are three different levels here that, you know, that are going to open up. One is the world of religious people involved in for-profit companies, whether they retain any free exercise rights for their religion. That's the Hobby Lobby level, of course. Then in the middle, you have the doctrinally defined nonprofit groups that still deal with the public, and that is adoption agencies, ministries to the poor, most notably Christian colleges and universities. And that's a completely different group in the middle. And then on the far side of that, you have actual churches with sanctuaries and doors. But the Supreme Court, in its previous history, has a long history of saying that it should not be up to the government to decide who gets to live by their doctrinal beliefs and who doesn't. So that middle sector is just it's just packed with landmines, as we've just seen that the Little Sisters of the Poor have just won again on the HHS mandate. This is not a clear area in law, and the discussions there are going to go like crazy. I've had numerous people tell me in the years leading up to this, in fact, for more than a decade, in one case, more than two decades, people saying in advance that when we actually get that Supreme Court decision, and this one wasn't it, when we get that actual decision that equates sexual orientation with race, that's going to make Roe v. Wade look like a walk in the park.
I want to come back to that on the other side of the break. It's an interesting comment. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of the Supreme Court's decision to legalize homosexual marriage on this Wednesday afternoon, July the 1st. Also, that term, deeply held religious beliefs, I want to come back to that as well. It seems to, it's a good category. It fails to distinguish between, say, Westboro Baptist Church and someone who has other sentiments, albeit them religious, about same-sex marriage and religious freedom. We'll be right back.
Hey, St. Louis. How would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
You might wonder, is it possible for my child with special needs to receive a rich classical Christian education? Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope answers yes. With the Simply Classical curriculum created by Cheryl and published by Memoria Press, there's no reason to withhold a beautiful education from any struggling student. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR. ClassicalSpecialNeeds.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We talk to the biggest names in religion today. Liberal Bishop John Shelby Spong.
I don't think Jesus ever preached the Sermon on the Mount, for example. I don't believe anybody ever took five loaves and two fish and fed 5,000 people. I don't believe that's possible to do.
Liberal Bible critic Bart Ehrman.
There's a difference between what the historical Jesus actually said and what the Gospels say he said. And to understand what the historical Jesus was really like, we have to get behind the Gospels.
Muslim critic of Christianity Reza Aslan.
By definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no right, no business commenting upon it.
Where else on Christian radio will you hear these guests challenged with important questions? Talk radio for the thinking Christian, Issues Etc. Listen live or on demand at issuesetc.org. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of the Supreme Court decision to legalize homosexual marriage. You said before the break, Terry, that when the case comes down, and you emphasize this one from Friday was not the case, that equates sexual preference with race, it'll make Roe v. Wade look like a walk in the park. What were you saying there?
Well, I mean, there are people who believe that the logic of Kennedy's recent decisions, and of course I mean Anthony Kennedy, the crucial man who's making all these decisions as the fifth vote on a severely divided Supreme Court, There are people who believe that every single thing he's writing is built on the logic of equating race and sexual orientation, but the court has not said that yet. So that's just simply a line that remains out there. This is another line that you don't see that covered very much in the media either. That seems to be the image du jour that everybody uses, but we're not there yet. But you see it constantly used in mainstream media, even, as I noted in Get Religion the other day, even in news stories, not editorial columns or commentary pieces, but even in hard news stories, you see that comparison used just as if that is a locked in concrete judicial or matter.
Well, I can almost guarantee if you're going to be Googling news stories on this, and if you Google landmark decision, you will find on one side of it a desegregation case, and on the other side, Friday's decision. They are often joined by that conjunction of landmark decision.
Yeah, and of course, the decision everybody really needs to be discussing is the Bob Jones case involving race years ago. The one you and I have talked about that we discussed when I was in graduate school in the late 70s, and then the decision actually was made in the early 80s, the one that stripped Bob Jones University of its tax status because of its doctrinal conviction against interracial dating. That is the case that came up during the debate at the Supreme Court for the current decision that led to the now famous reference where the lawyer arguing for the plaintiff said that could this lead to the loss of tax status, and the government lawyer said, of course, yeah, well, that's a very real possibility. And so you've seen lots and lots of discussion of that in recent days as well.
What about this term, and you quoted someone using it earlier in our conversation, deeply held religious beliefs. The thing that concerns me about it is that it's so vague as to be able to include, say, advocates of Westboro Baptist Church and rational Christians who say, look, I'm concerned about homosexual marriage, but primarily because of, maybe only because of the impact this decision may have on religious freedom in general.
Well, you've got to separate there what these different groups want to do. Westboro Baptist isn't selling flowers, baking pizzas, or doing anything else related to weddings. The Westboro Baptist situation is a pure freedom of speech situation. And so the court has only recently, of course, found that, you know, the Westboro Baptist retains its free speech rights. We're dealing here with a kind of an apples and oranges situation. In particular, note, if you may recall, that the Westboro Baptist case, you ended up with major news organizations filing briefs on the side of Westboro Baptist, backing that church, that tiny, bizarre church, because the case actually pivoted on the fact that people that were offended by them and felt wounded by them had not actually seen their demonstration but had only seen news coverage of it. At which point now, not only were you talking about limiting the free speech rights of Westboro Baptist, you were talking about limiting the rights of news agencies to cover them. At which point the Washington Post and a bunch of other people freaked out, as they should, and once again there was a stand for free speech. The issue now, once again, concerns more than free speech. It concerns more than publishing. It concerns more than what you say inside the doors of your church. It's whether or not people have the right to the free exercise of religion when their actions actually take them into contact with other citizens.
So what does – we often talk about this, Terry. What does the conscientious editor at the news desk – what kind of assignments should he be handing out now after Friday's decision?
Well, I mean, once again, we need to go back to where we started. Clearly, editors disagree with each other on this. We talk so much about the famous statement by Bill Keller, the former editor of the New York Times, who said that that his newspaper did not slant political coverage, but that on issues of religion and morality that there were cases when it did slant the news. And he admitted that in remarks in Austin a number of years ago. Well, we've seen that same issue come up again on CNN and discussions there and elsewhere, but perfectly stated by Ben Smith, the editor of the very influential online website, especially online news for the young, BuzzFeed, so famous for its use of GIFs and turning humor into the news, etc. And in an interview with the Politico, he said, and I assume in this case "we" means the editor, the people who run BuzzFeed, "we firmly believe that for a number of issues, including civil rights, women's rights, anti-racism, and LGBT equality, there are not two sides of the story," which means there is no need to make assignments that attempt to accurately report traditional religious believers or old-fashioned First Amendment liberals or people on the other side of this issue, because this is now a story that does not have two sides. Now, you're not seeing many mainstream media people saying that, but it is definitely being debated, as we saw on CNN, you know, in an encounter between Molly Ziegler-Hemingway and another journalist from BuzzFeed, Chris Geidner, who is their legal affairs editor, who is openly gay and has made that the basis of a lot of his reporting for more than a decade. You saw the two of them where he insisted that he was still being as objective as he possibly could be, and that he was very interested in the views of people on all sides of this issue and felt that he was adequately covering them, yet he's working for an editor that says this issue does not have two sides. The most inflammatory thing that he said in that interview before Molly got on and basically went get religion on them to some degree, he said that also when you actually look at the content of BuzzFeed's coverage, he saw no difference at all in the content between BuzzFeed's coverage and the front page coverage in the New York Times and the Washington Post. I would imagine you could have a lively debate with the editors there that they felt their coverage was as slanted as the coverage being led by Ben Smith.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. He's founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
When we come back, Pastor Tom Baker is going to join us. We'll teach a little Sunday school lesson with him from Luke chapter 2, Jesus, True Man, the birth of Jesus, right here in the middle or at the beginning of July. And then Pastor Mark Serberg will join us. We'll talk about, well, it's often said, and it's often a mantra of the advocacies of homosexual and homosexual lifestyle, "I was born that way." You know, they didn't make that one up. Christians had that one first. We might be saying, join the club. We were all born that way. We'll get his thoughts on that in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. in hour two. When we come back, we're going to look at the birth of Jesus in Luke chapter 2. There's more going on here than just the cute little story of a manger and a mother and the animals gathered around the birth of Jesus. This is, in fact, this is a singular event in human history, where the creator of the universe enters creation and takes on human flesh and affects our salvation. We'll talk about that with Pastor Tom Baker right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to 8th grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.